Tom Chick. You're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week, if you have not seen 44-inch Chest, I would advise, personally, I would advise doing so. I would also advise fast-forwarding to the part of the podcast where we do our 3x3, because we are going to spoil it. In my spoilage of this movie, I will be accompanied by Christian Milsaski.
Saluti.
I also have with me Kelly Wand, who may or may not have a tagline for us this week. I don't know. I can never tell. Kelly, is there a tagline this week?
When have I not had a tagline? And that's not the tagline. Here's the tagline. A 44-inch chest means 43-inch heartbreak.
Very
when
good.
You're dumped. Maybe it's just better without the when you're dumped. All right. Start all over.
Well, why don't you give us a plot synopsis of this movie, Kelly Wand?
I'd be happy to, Tom. Okay, so Ray Winstone freaks out his poodle by beating up Joanne Whaley because she's cheating on him with French waiter and a bloody tank top. So his lovable aging buddies, like in The Hangover, lock the dude in a wardrobe, and Ian McShane's like a gay Aslan. But Winston works it all out by picturing his friends as chauffeurs and Joanne Whaley licking his window, which is how Val Kilmer worked out when she divorced him in RL. The end.
Very good. All right. That works for me.
See, I spoiled real life there, too. I spoiled a lot of things.
That's true. I hope if you have not seen 44-inch Chest, you did not hear that. You would not want to know that. Dingus, why don't you now tell us what you thought of the movie? What... You didn't know anything going in, correct? I'd shown you, you'd seen the one little opening shot, but other than that, I presume you knew nothing, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Just that opening shot with Jeff Bridges when he turns into Roy Winstone.
And tell us a bit about what it was like being at the far end of the movie, having just seen it. Go.
At the far end of the movie?
What's that? What's that mean? I didn't understand. That was more distracting than anything.
When you get to the
far end of the movie, that's not a phrase.
Yeah, it is. Like when before you've seen a movie, you're here.
The far end.
And then at the other end of the movie, yeah, is afterwards. The far end.
Huh. Yeah. Okay. 44-inch movie. Hey, I thought this movie was about strippers when I heard the title. Did you guys get any? Okay, never mind. Far end of the movie. Here we go. Dingus.
The far end of the movie, coupled with Kelly Wand's Narnia reference, have really got me thinking I watched the wrong movie. By the way, it's Ray Winstone, not Roy Winstone. I don't know what the hell I was thinking. All right. What am I supposed to say? What I thought about it?
Yeah. Just describe.
At the far end of the movie.
Yeah. Describe your reaction to it.
That's what Tom said specifically. Not to the movie, but the far end.
There's something that I get particularly excited about when I watch a film, and it's if I could see this film or if I think this film, and I don't know if there's any background of this as far as the film is concerned, but if I could see this film easily working out as a play and it exciting me to see it that way and still working as a film really jazzes me. And this film has such a wonderful, contained, play-like quality. And the moments where it opens up are still so well done that it doesn't feel forced. It doesn't feel like it's being forced from the stage to the screen. So I'm very, very excited about this film. It just has this wonderful feeling of these old actors who've been corralled into this room to do an incredible play in a very small space, and it just feels like an explosion to me.
Part of me, I mean, I absolutely agree, Dingus, but I kind of am bummed in a way that movies aren't more willing to have contained settings like this, that when you make a movie, you feel like you need to range far and wide, and this movie doesn't need that. So I wish that more movies could accept that and not fit in this special category of, hey, this could have been a play. And this does very well. Like the setting in this movie, and it could be a play. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's a few things you would lose.
Open water could be a play, because it has one location.
Yeah. I'm imagining some logistical problems that would have, but open water is actually kind of a good example in that open water is just the two actors interacting with the situation. That's pretty much all there is to open water. And the same is kind of true of 44-inch chest. It's these five men in a beautifully designed, like the production design on this looks fantastic, in this dingy old room where they've obviously been before. The first thing Ian McShane says when they walk in is déjà vu.
Exactly.
And they don't explain that. It's not very clear. There's no exposition here. It's not clear what these men do or what they have done or why they've been in this room before. But they're obviously comfortable with having kidnapped someone, and they're ready to deal with having to murder this person. So that's all you know about their background, basically.
And he says that upon looking at the chest.
Déjà vu?
Yeah.
Ah, I didn't realize that. Well, and certainly Mal, at one point, who's the only actor I didn't know, Stephen Delane, he at one point says, hey, I'm not the guy in the chest, as if that is a place, that's a position that they've dealt with before, is having somebody in this chest. Right. All right, so Kelly Wan, what you come out of the far end of this movie, I presume you didn't know anything about it either, right? Because I was the one gunning talking about this movie, because it came out on
DVD. You said it was the Sexy Beast, guys.
Right. And it just came out on DVD last week, so I was the one gunning for us to see this. So you knew that it was the Sexy Beast, guys. I presume you knew nothing else. What was it like coming out of the far end of it, Kelly Wand? How did it work for you?
It's another movie where I liked coming in nude at the far end and emerging clothed in its greatness.
Wait, did you watch this?
It was like a mammoth. It's like British. Yeah. Well, I accidentally saw the last shot. Never mind. I'm a movies where nothing happens apologist.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I like movies where it's like not the biggest events in those people's lives. It's just like their day. Like that movie, do you remember this movie called Miami Blues?
Absolutely. Fred Ward and Alec
Baldwin. Ed Tench's in it. Yeah. Alec Baldwin, yeah. And so it's just like them just hanging out, I guess. Like it's him chasing the guy, but at the end of the movie, Fred Ward's kind of learned nothing. Like he's just, I don't know.
I understand what you're saying about a movie where nothing happens, because what you're set up for throughout 44-inch chest is that this is going to be a violent, bloody revenge drama. And until it was over, I was not convinced that the guy with whom his wife had an affair was going to get out of that room. I mean, I was certain that we were being set up for some sort of Reservoir Dogs ear-severing scene or something like that.
Right.
And because partly, for many reasons, partly because of the source material this movie draws from, partly because it was the two writers of Sexy Beast, which had its own very violent ending. That's one thing I really admired about the movie, is that did not happen. And you say, Kelly, how Fred Ward didn't really learn anything at the end of Miami Blues. I don't think that applies here, because there's a very definite character arc for what Ray Winstone does. I think the change that he undergoes and this acceptance that he comes to is tremendous.
Yeah, that's Miami Blues is probably a bad example, because that's not. That's
but you're right though. But you are right though that it's a movie where nothing happens. This violent finale that we're expecting throughout the movie does not happen, and what happens instead is a character arc. You know, mm-hmm. Dramatic change in this character.
Like The Sopranos. It's a Sopranos ending. Because it gets metaphysical, too. Like Sopranos.
How does it get metaphysical?
Well, he imagines this whole fate.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying. Right. It really does get into his mind. Like his state of mind and his, being. Yes, fair enough. Right.
I mean, it's not a Sopranos ending in that he might be dead or not. Just, it doesn't end in a hail of bullets or blood. Like, it's just this really quiet ending.
Yes.
I liked that. Like, I felt we knew all the dudes as well as we needed to enjoy the movie and to get their characters and, like, where they were all coming from. But I wondered if we needed to know Liz better to get why she left. Like, I couldn't understand why that girl would be with Winstone. Like, he seems really hard to be with, and they've been married 21 years. And she's 43 now. I don't know.
Well, that is a fair point, Kelly, in that we don't really see their relationship. We see his recollection. We see the breakup.
And we see his fantasies of her.
Right. She, in a way, is not part of the movie. So that's a fair point.
But is that a problem with the movie, or am I a bit dumb?
I have an answer for this. Dingus, go ahead. Dingus?
I don't think it is. I think that...
Because it's not about her.
Well, it's not just that. I think that she gives everything that we need to see. And there's so much that goes on in that... If you look at their scene together in their house as one scene that's broken up, not discounting, but let's put the marriage contract over here. Let's put the violence that happens over here, and just think about the way their scene works together when he gets home bearing gifts and she says she's sorry, she confesses to him, they sit down, and he has this whole thing that he goes through, and she has something that she's going through on the other side of the table, and she says it, she takes his hand and she says, this hasn't been working for me. And regardless of what he says or how he sees the relationship, I think you get a hell of a lot from her. Not just in the way she looks. I mean, she looks incredible. She's got this incredible, beautiful weariness about her. But also in the way she deals with him and the way she clearly loves him and she's tender with him in this moment where she's betrayed him and she's confessing that. But she's also just very firm with him and saying, this hasn't been working for a long time. And I get a world of their relationship in that scene.
All right, here's what I'm getting snagged on. She's been with him a long time, and she seems intelligent. And like, I see why he likes her, but I don't know why she wouldn't expect his reaction, because she has to know what he's capable of.
I think she does. Like, she immediately tries to leave when he – because Ray Winstone is so phenomenal in that scene. I mean, he's so amazing in this movie throughout, but specifically in that scene, the clear demarcation of the stages that he's going through –
yeah.
Is just some great work, and she knows when he starts to go into that violent phase and starts to leave. And it's like Dingus is saying, I think it's an example of two actors working well together and the material's good, that we get a glimpse of the fact that she knows where he's going to go. You know, she realizes when she needs to get out of the house and when she's going to have to stop talking to him. It doesn't help her ultimately. But you get this sense that, okay, when he starts to get really dark, she's like, okay, I've got to get out. I can't stay here. Like, she knows she's got
to. Why would she take that chance? And she does give up her lover to him. And
doesn't he beats it out of her. I mean, yeah, I don't think she gives it up so much as.
Yeah, but then the next day they get him at work. Doesn't she call him and go, dude, you might want to leave town for a while?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know.
Well, I think I don't know that he's her lover in the sense that he's just a guy. I mean, that's a specific word she uses, in that that Ray Winstone's character derides her for. She's talking about him as a guy, and I don't know that he's somebody that she would necessarily leave him for as so much as an excuse to leave.
Go ahead, Dingus.
But she's signing his death warrant.
Well, let me – again, she's not it's very clear that she's not going to give the guy's name, and you almost imagine that maybe she comes up with this guy. I mean, I believe the movie intends that they had an affair, but she uses this as a way to pry herself loose from Ray Winstone, that she's using that as leverage, not that she's going to leave with this guy, but that happened, and that's how she's going to try to drive him away and make it final. And she doesn't give him up, because it is clear that it's only after he beats her that she says his name. But let me throw this.
She does give him up.
Right, right. But I don't think you could stand up under torture.
Well, what are you going to do?
Right.
No, but I wouldn't be in the house to like do that. Like, now I'm putting two lives in my hands by having, instead of breaking up by email.
Well, these are like logistic-y kind of things, and I sort of agree with what you're saying. Some is problematic. Okay. Well, yeah, I was going
to
say,
she gets making it sound like she was planning, like, oh, she just wants to get out of Winstone, so she has this guy, like, this is her way out. But it seems like a plan riddled with potential disasters.
Well, I think the bottom line, Kelly Wand, is her perspective and her plan, that's not part of the movie. That's not really part of what the movie is about. And I would say that a better way to look at this in a way almost is this is another story about something that is epic, and it's the stuff of mythology and the Bible and Shakespeare. Namely, it's about the rage and irrationality and the pathetic state of a man betrayed by a woman. I mean, it's the stuff of soap operas set in this parlor room drama. You know, the source material for 44-inch chest is basically, and this is acknowledged in the movie, the story of Samson and Delilah, Pagliacci, the opera about the cuckolded clown, or Othello, even the Iliad. You know, the war in the Iliad is precipitated by someone being cuckolded. And in this situation, in this sort of mythic source material, the woman is almost beside the point. In the source material, these stories are just about how men are brought low, no matter how powerful they are, no matter how convicted or self-assured, or no matter their place in the world, no matter how strong in the sense of Samson, no matter how composed, this ruins men. Why and how the women do it and their perspective, that's kind of not part of the dramatic equation, I would say. So that's why that a lot of the stuff about her perspective, I was okay with it not really being in the movie.
Yeah, and I am too. I just wonder about that stuff.
Sure, absolutely.
Because if he's doing these fantasies too about what she's like, I mean, maybe she didn't betray. I don't know. We're not sure what her thing was. I don't know, it isn't about her.
But still, I think she's more vividly drawn than, say, Delilah is.
Well, Hedy Lamarr, come on.
Yeah.
How dare you?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, you didn't have a choice.
Let's talk a bit about Ray Winstone. Have you guys seen him better in anything? I mean, he's so good so often, but there's just so much for him to chew on here.
He's that good in Sexy Beast. And he plays a similar dude who's really into his woman.
Mm-hmm. I don't recall, I didn't realize, and I don't know if I just missed it, I missed you saying it, or what. I didn't realize that there was any connection to Sexy Beast until I started watching it and started feeling like, wow, this feels like Sexy Beast. I recall him being great in Sexy Beast, and I loved that film. But I don't recall him having the kind of playground or toolbox in that film as he had here. There was so much he had to do, and so many shifts that he had to do and did so well. And how he conveys such incredible power and menace one moment, and then such crushing fragility and vulnerability in the next, just phenomenal to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is like I look at something like that and I'm like, wow, that's the culmination of a career. I mean, that right there is what great acting is about. There's, you can see some of that menace in, for instance, The War Zone, which is a movie I think we've talked about, which is incredibly brutal and difficult to watch. And
yeah.
The War Zone is a little, it's not vulnerability, but there's some of that patheticness to him in The War Zone. But he's like this raging lion in this at times. It really is just amazing to watch. And the camera is so close on his face, too. That's another thing, Dingus, that, you know, you say this could be a play, but one of the things that would be missing in a play is the level of intimacy you get with the camera being right up there and seeing how dark his eyes get and the tears welling up at the bottom of his eyes. I mean, that's something that you would miss in a play, or you wouldn't at least be able to appreciate as well.
Right, and I certainly imagine like a little black box theater when I'm thinking of it as a play. Just being able to see some of those things you're saying, just that stricken look and his dazed, that dazed sense of his sweaty drunkenness and how lost he feels as they're talking about him around him.
Right.
He just is so broken and yet so powerful at the same time. I don't know many actors who can carry that off.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that he's a wreck and can barely, he's incapacitated, and one of his friends is like a beanpole. One of them wears dentures, and one of them's gay. And these old men all get that young buff waiter, like pound, like tied up and take him in a van in broad daylight to some apartment.
In broad daylight, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I buy into it. I like it. It's like, oh, that's not a problem. Like, they're not even worried about police pursuit or, like, how many hours they've been gone or alibis. Or, like, there's no talk of any of it. Like, all right.
Nobody's wearing a mask. Nobody cares if they're identified.
Right.
You know, says, you know, go back to your, what does he say? Go back to your snails or whatever.
Yeah, and it's Tom Wilkinson wielding a big old pepper grinder that he's just picked up from one of the tables. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, he's banging it on there, and I'm like, oh, he brought a club with him. And then I realize, no, he just grabbed a pepper grinder from one of the tables, and then he tosses it into a potted plant as they drive off. You know, they're not armed. They don't...
Yeah.
But you get the sense. I don't know how clear this was to you guys.
That tells you about their characters.
Right. Exactly. And so I've seen it twice. I saw it during its theatrical release, and then I saw the DVD. But you get the sense there's that one scene which, if you see it the first time, it's things fall into place kind of – gradually, and you're not always clear, okay, what's going on, who is who. But there's that one scene where Tom Wilkinson is talking to a character named Biggie, who's got Rosemary, the little dog there, that this guy is sort of the crime lord or the mafioso or whatever with whom they have to clear everything to let him know, okay, here's what we're doing. And they refer to Biggie a couple of times. You know, Meredith says Biggie doesn't like me.
Right.
But that's sort of all the groundwork that's laid for what all they're going to do. You know, you don't hear anything about the safe house or how they're going to get rid of the body. There's just that one innocuous conversation where Biggie – that starts, you know, in the middle of the conversation where Biggie says something about, you know, cuckoldry. It's a terrible word. It's a terrible thing.
That's got the talking dog, right?
Yeah. With Rosemary, yeah. So how's Rosemary then? I don't know.
Don't you ask her?
Yeah. and it ends, and it's so British. So much in this movie is so British. It ends with Biggie saying, "Toodle pip."
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that's like all
that's
the time.
That's so British Mammoth. It's like Mammoth meets Dickens.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Well, and even, you know, the language in this and the profanity is so uniquely British, too. I mean, the way the British can get away with the C word and giving it this fluid poetry and making it flow with the F word and... the writers of Sexy Beast, their names are Lewis Mellis and David, I'm assuming it's Cinto, it might be Skinto, but these guys are so mammothesque, but so very British with the poetry of profanity. When we had our 3x3 of favorite instances of the F word, this movie was one of my choices. And it's so British, the scene where the four of them, Ray Winstone's just kind of sitting there, so the four of them are basically standing in a circle around the tied-up waiter, taking turns insulting him, is just such a lovely poetic beating. And it's so British, too.
and they're not even insulting him in the way that you would think by tearing him down. They're suggesting the things he's done to her.
Yes.
And they're these old men.
Yeah, and they're getting into all these details.
And saying their idea of what must have gone on between this young man and this woman. And it's and all I can think of is this is beating up Ray Winstone more than it's beating up the waiter.
Right.
I mean, it's such brutality and so so clumsy at the same time, and yet you get this feeling that this is a crew that have done this before.
That's how British friends are. That's what I got out of it. That's their way they talk you up, stiff upper lip.
Well, one thing. Go ahead, Dingus.
Well, I was just going to say I'm fascinated by one of the things I love about this film is that it doesn't get bogged down in telling us their history. It doesn't bother to give us a whole bunch of exposition about what this crew did or if they were a crew or if they're a loose group of friends who have done this before. It just lets us come to it by showing us the relationship and showing us their reactions to being in this room. Mm-hmm. And I love sitting there and thinking, who is this guy Biggie? is he the crime boss? What is their relationship to each other? How long have they been in each other's lives? What are their roles in the gang? How often do they do jobs together? Have they done a job in a while? And just, and not being distracted by that, but just, it just creates this richness about their characters and about their situation that is just phenomenal. And there's a one moment near the end in his, in this extended scene that I really want to talk about, where it becomes a dream and then a dream within a dream, or a flashback within a flashback. There's just one little shot where that, I think Biggie comes back, that I just get so confused about who these guys are, and but it doesn't distract me from loving what's going on in their relationships.
Mm-hmm. When you find out who they are by what they say and through the situation.
And how they react to each other, their interactions.
I think it's a sign of a classic film when you don't know the character's background. It's like that'll always ruin a character. That'll always make them crappier.
If this had been made by like Joe Carnahan or Tony Scott or something,
like,
each character would
like
have been introduced.
Like Rhett Butler's childhood or Han Solo's childhood. Wouldn't that suck? Wouldn't that totally ruin everything about Han Solo? Okay, what? Joe Carnahan?
I wish you hadn't said that out loud, because now George Lucas is going to start working on it.
You know, no one's going to watch him anymore. So John Hurt was like the old version of the Ben Kingsley character from Sexy Beast.
Well, they're definitely what's Ben Kingsley's name in Sexy Beast? Don. There are definitely traces of Don in a lot of them. And I do wonder if they wrote it intending, because Ian McShane was also in Sexy Beast.
Right.
So I do wonder if they wrote it hoping to get Ben Kingsley in one of the parts. And I wondered that as well. Would Ben Kingsley have been Old Man Peanut? But I'm glad
they got John Hurt.
John Hurt really made that his own. I mean, I never got the sense like that these were words that should have been Ben Kingsley saying them. I mean, just John Hurt as this bitter, conservative old man who... Still, though, was so, even though they were so tough and abrasive, there was so much, in an odd way, tenderness in terms of how they obviously felt about each other.
Yeah.
And even the supposed tension between Old Man Peanut and Meredith, John Hurt's character and Ian McShane's character, about homosexuality and whatnot. I mean, you got the sense that, you know, they gave each other grief, but they still, at the end, as a matter of fact, I think John Hurt really is going to go to the gay club with Ian McShane to get breakfast.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I think so, too. I think that they've played this many times, and you see that when Tom Wilkinson is basically saying, will you two cut it out?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're asking about Tom Wilkinson's mother, and Tom Wilkinson asks about, I think, Mal's aunt. You know, they certainly with the way they interact with Ray Winstone. I mean, there's just a lot of... I guess you would call it latent tenderness towards, in terms of how they feel. And even when he starts to lash out at Mal, you know, they understand that. And
even the victim, like, bonds with them. Like, yeah, I know.
With Ray Winstone.
Well, yeah, a little bit. That's what kind of gets him off the hook.
I think that's the character arc, is that Ray Winstone, for whatever reason, ends up basically weeping on the guy's leg. And the guy raises, I mean, it's such, I love, too, how little they did with the waiter character. I love
he didn't speak. No dialogue.
And I love how often and his eyes were lowered early on, and you couldn't really make out his face. I mean, I love that he's got a bag over his head most of the time. I mean, he starts out being an object. He's going to be the corpse. He's going to be the guy who gets his ear cut off or who gets bloodily beaten, and he's gradually revealed. You know, the bag's taken off. He starts raising his eyes. He participates in the flashback. You know, Ray Winstone basically invites this man into his mind and interacts with him in his mind, and all it takes for the man to get off the hook, as you said, Kelly Wand, is to basically, I guess, raise his hand and put it on Ray Winstone's head. Is this?
He understands.
He does, and that.
And he conveys
kind of,
that the whole movie with no words, which is pretty cool. And in the clock.
It's like he heals him there. That moment where he puts his hands on his head and his hands are bound. It's a very Christ-like little moment there. It's like he's healing him. There's a change there. It's a fascinating, just beautiful, tender moment.
Although I do wonder, I think at that point, Ray Winstone knows he's not going to kill him. I mean, Ray Winstone's come to that decision, so I don't know that it's so much the guy gets himself off the hook by touching him, but it is a moment of solidarity. Yeah. And I think it's very important that we see that. I mean, I think that's the culmination of the movie right there.
Yeah. Well, and he's conveyed a solidarity somehow before that by not begging for his life and not acting like he doesn't know what Ray Winstone's talking about.
You know what? You're right. That is a very – it's an interesting and important choice for that character, that he doesn't beg for his life, that he's not like the cop in Reservoir Dogs. It makes
a big
difference.
He doesn't deny anything.
Yeah, exactly, and that he doesn't deny it, and he doesn't say, I don't know what you guys are talking about. You know, why have you kidnapped me? And, you know, maybe that was supposed to have gone on earlier. Obviously, they did rough him up a bit. He's bloodied.
It's not just that. I've watched it twice, too, and I think I get the sense that he's been there for 2 days. They took him. Something happened that there was a night before, and now they're in the next night. I don't know how that works out time-wise.
Why do you think that? Why do you think he's there too?
Because they keep referring to what happened last night, and he's so beat up and
right. I think, Dingus, what you're thinking of, though, is that's the night where they come together, where Ray Winstone calls Archie. You know, and they come to, and then you get the telephone call to Meredith. I don't know why we didn't get to see a call to Mal or Old Man Peanut, but I think that was the first night. And then the next morning, they pick up the waiter. He's in the chest throughout the day, and then this is the second night that we're basically seeing, and it ends with the dawn, at which point Ray Winstone is leaving the house. That's the impression
I got. Yeah. That makes more sense, because I can't imagine Liz crawling around in the field for a day and a half.
Right. Any favorite lines?
Can't remember them all.
There's just so many good poetic bits that I jotted down. Like at one point, John Hurt has they all have amazing, just lovely monologues and moments and just instances of dialogue. John Hurt has this, you know, you used the word metaphysical before, Kelly, but John Hurt at one point has this thing where he's declaiming, this is where we are, here, now, this. I mean, that's just a great, amazing line. I love that. This is where we are, here, now, this. I mean, just the cadence of here, now, this.
Now, this.
It's lovely. And also, I think, I think this might be John Hurt as well. Look at the man, where is he? Look at the man, he ain't there. I mean, that's a great little couplet. That is a bona fide couplet, I think. And of course, it loses something if you're not British. And their accents are just so strong and so street, I guess, as far as what it was like there. It lends so much to the dialogue.
I really loved Ray Winstone. What's his character's name?
Colin Diamond.
Colin Diamond. I love Colin's when he's talking to the waiter and explaining what love is to him and saying,
yes,
love's hard work, love's hard graft.
Oh, God, yes.
Love, and this is the part that got me. Love can be murder. Love is watching what she wants to watch on the telly.
Yeah.
We know you know that one, Dingus.
Yeah.
But there's
all those episodes of Gilmore Girls. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Thank you for outing me, by the way.
I was just going to say, that whole sequence right there, like Ray Winstone's monologue, uncut, straight into the camera. You know, the camera must have been like, you know, 6 inches from his face. That was just amazing. Yeah. I'm sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
Well, would 44-inch chest be the movie that the girlfriend would want to watch on the telly? You want to watch it, and then
this isn't much of a date movie, I'd say.
I like a line the size of a Toblerone was good.
Yes, and that whole flashback, by the way. First of all, again, Ian McShane had some great exchanges. His explanation to Colin about how he should be proud that he is vulnerable and he can love. But he's not like that, you know. When he then contrasts himself and the five Fs. That whole sequence, too. God, what a brilliant bit of just give Ian McShane this monologue, put the camera on him, and it's just magic. I just loved that bit. And it even ends with something like Ray Winstone saying, well, why should I be proud? And Ian McShane doesn't really have an answer for that.
Yeah, the whole way he pulls him out of his heart attack, panic attack thing,
yes.
With what exactly what you're saying, you know, you should be proud, you know, you're a human and you feel things. Of course, I don't, and he walks off. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal work. And just to be able to say, you know, you guys were talking about Ben Kingsley. I can't imagine what Ben Kingsley would play in this. I think these guys are all perfect for their parts. I don't know that he has a part in this. I don't think there's a part for him here. I mean, I really love him as an actor, but these guys are so great in these parts.
Yeah, yeah.
And watching Ian McShane, you know, talk about, you know, what I do with my 9.5 has nothing to do with me.
It's yeah.
Fantastic. And just the way he uses his eyes when he's not looking at Peanut, but sort of looking at him, or anybody he sort of looks at. I mean, it's a fantastic part, and it's not even the greatest work in this film, but it's great, great work.
Only Ian McShane could get away so well with the line, "We'll have a fag in the passage." why?
I like, "You should have got your own fucking wife to fuck." I like that line. And I liked it when they were talking about this human stink bomb, and they called him the cunt with the ears, who pen and ink something terrible. I liked that.
Okay, Juan, it doesn't work so well when you say it without the accent, I'm afraid. Nice try.
I don't want to mangle it. I wish I would have been a fly on the wall on the day that they told John Hurt and Ian McShane, okay, Ian, you're going to be the gay guy. John Hurt, you're going to be the angry guy who swears a lot.
Now, went, wasn't,
yeah, perfect.
Wasn't Ian McShane's character in Sexy Beast gay?
I don't think so. I don't remember that character detail.
I've never seen Ian McShane gay before, I'm pretty sure. I'd remember.
I just remember this moment. There's one moment where it's just this weird flash that I think Ray Winstone's character in that has a mental image of Ian McShane on like all fours, soaking wet and tossing his head. And there's no other sense of what's going on in that.
Oh.
It just has this feel of like, what?
Oh, God, I do remember that. You might be right, Dingus.
The suggestion seems to be that there's something else going on there, and I never really went back and looked at it again to see where else that bears out.
Yeah, thanks for that's an image. Thanks for putting that image in my head.
Wait, who and him?
It's just him. There's nobody. I don't remember anybody else being there. I just remember it being this animalistic moment, like he's in some bathhouse or something, but it's a very sexual moment, and it's just a split second, as far as I remember it. I've only seen Sexy Beast once, but that image really stuck with me, and when I saw this, it sort of called to mind that.
Now, why do we not know who Stephen Delane is? Although, actually, I did recognize him from something. Had you guys seen him in anything else? I don't think you guys saw what I'm thinking of.
No. He's got a Jonathan Pryce thing going.
Uh-huh. He does kind of, yeah.
Oh, guys.
Well, at first, I thought he was supposed to be John Hurt's son, because he calls him Poppy, but then somebody else calls him Poppy too, so it's clearly not everybody calls him Peanut. Sometimes they call him Poppy because he's right. The old guy.
Right.
So I didn't really get who he was.
Well, the actor was played Thomas Jefferson in that horrible Paul Giamatti miniseries on HBO, John Adams. Yeah.
No, wait, John Adams ruled. What are you talking about?
Oh, God. Oh, for sake, don't get me started.
Pones.
I really did like Stephen Delane as Jefferson, though, in that. Oh, and Tom Wilkinson was in that as well. As Ben.
That's right.
One.
See?
The reunion.
How could you not like that?
And I think also, wasn't Ray Winstone in that as George Washington?
David
Morris. I know.
Why do you hate John Adams? Never mind.
I hate John Adams because I thought Paul Giamatti was terrible in it. He did. I don't think he does period work very well, and that distracted me. So there you go. That's why I hate John Adams.
All right.
Why do you like John Adams?
Because I'm gay for anything from that era. And it was like, I don't know. Remember that part in the boat? You didn't like that?
I do not remember a part in a boat. Unless Laura Linney was in the scene, I probably didn't really care for it. She was.
Yeah, see, she's good.
She's good, yeah.
Right.
Laura Linney. She's no Hope Davis, but she's good.
So I have a question about one thing that sticks out for me. There's that sequence where it's like he's having a dream within a dream at the end. Not at the end, but. They're all in the room, and then he, you know, he imagines them all in the room, and Liz is in the room as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the you know, rubbing down a car is hard work kind of flash over to that, and then you've got what's his name? What's Mal? Mal saying he's going to have a Kit Kat, and then like winking at the camera, and then it's
and then he has a Kit Kat.
A Kit Kat, but it's still within the first dream, not within sort of the other flashback of the dream.
Right.
And then he has this moment, and I can't remember who says it, but somebody says to him, "You're the thing in the basement with a hood on."
Right.
And then there's this flash of him tied up with a hood on. His hood is ripped off, and I think it's Biggie, but I'm not sure.
No, it's John Hurt. It's John Hurt with a knife or something.
Yeah, holding like this weird curved knife. You sure that's John Hurt?
Yeah.
All right. So, because that was just weird. It seemed like a different visual moment. And for a second, I thought, this is what's really going on, and everything we're seeing now is just in his head.
Oh, dang it.
And then I got to go out of that for a second. But all of that is just so layered of all these different flashbacks within flashbacks or dream within dreams.
Right. And I think that's just representative of course, his fear that his friends are making fun of him, that he is being ridiculed, that he is indeed ridiculous. That's what I got from that.
So he projects that Mal liked his wife, liked Liz.
Well, I think that's more of that really universal, who am I going to be most insecure about?
Right.
Of my friends.
Who can I imagine?
Right. Yeah, Mal's sort of the unlucky guy who comes up, for lack of something better.
She wouldn't sleep with John Hurt. Right, okay.
well, the chauffeur fantasy starts with...
That's so funny. Yeah. That's right. The best-looking one of them, of course, the most smooth and charismatic, who then explains, wait a minute, I'm gay.
What am I doing?
It's like they tag off.
Right.
So what's the window represent that she licks?
I don't know. You tell us. What do you got for us, Kelly Wand?
Oh, I have to it's his Winstone's Winstone?
I just love... I love how unhinged and funny all that stuff is. Like, I love that it did that to sort of, in a way, release some of the tension, but also really showing us his state of mind. That we're seeing this amazing performance from Ray Winstone, and that we get to go into his head and see more of what's going on in there. I love that it did that.
I also really loved the music. I just want to mention that before we go on.
Angela Badalamenti.
Yeah.
Dingus, can you hum a little bit of the soundtrack to 44 Inch Chest for us?
I really can't, but I could probably hum a little bit of the soundtrack of Twin Peaks, which is the only reason I really know Angela Badalamenti.
Right.
Oh, so it was the White Lodge that she was in.
Right.
And two great uses, by the way, of not, what do you call it, not found music. What is it when there's a pre-existing song in a movie? There's a word.
Eidetic? Wait, eidetic?
Is it not found music? Anyway, I loved the, even eidetic. Though it was kind of, it was brief, it didn't necessarily, it fit, I thought. It was a little out of the blue. But when he's flipping the coin, that quick Tom Jones riff was awesome. I loved that bit. When they're all looking for where the coin is going to land. And when he's laying there listening to that, I thought it was an Air Supply song, but it's not. It's a guy named Harry Nilsson. Just that cheesy pop swelling, She Left Me schmaltz, that song Without You. I love the opening of it, and that he reaches over and flips it on when Tom Wilkinson is trying to console him early in the movie.
That was one of my favorite moments early on, when he reaches over and turns on the stereo, which is stacked sort of haphazardly next to him in the mess. It's just, oh, beautiful. What does he say? Come on here, mate, you can't lie there forever. And he leans over and clicks on You Can't Live. Which, you know, Nilsson did a lot of movie stuff, I think. Didn't he do the Midnight Cowboy song?
I don't know, he might have.
But I love that we got to hear that song, because in the opening, you think he's dead.
God, that opening is tremendous. Yeah, describe it for us, Dingus.
Well, it's just the camera moves. Well, Kelly's sort of given us a summary, you know, what the dog is going through and all the broken glass and the general mayhem of the room and the camera going on to him just lying there with his eyes open on the floor as if he's dead.
Because it's the classic corpse shot, and especially after seeing all this. And it also, the camera makes a point to show us that he's got, like, bloodied knuckles, you know, that he's wounded from some kind of fight or something.
And that the hand's not moving, and it holds on the hand for a long time.
I mean, this is movie language for a guy who's dead, which he a couple of times says, you know, you've killed me, I'm dead, I'm not here.
Right.
And they even say, you know, that line I was talking about, you know, look at the man, where is he? Look at the man, he ain't there. So this is classic movie vocabulary for a corpse. And it's almost musically timed with the song when he finally blinks, and you're like, holy cow, this guy isn't dead. He's something worse, you know. He's in quite a state.
Or the whole movie's his dying hallucination, like Taxi Driver.
Yeah, you could go with that, or like Minority Report, or sure, could all be in
Nerd Alert.
He says this great line to the waiter where he talks about wanting to kill him, and he really wants to kill him or take his life, and his line is, "You owe me that." Which is just amazing for his state of mind. You owe me that.
Yeah.
And all I can think of is this poor guy. Part of me was thinking about, God help me, the O.J. Simpson thing with a waiter going home with a rich woman and then getting caught in the crossfire. And this waiter sitting there and me wanting him to say, well, just say, I didn't know who the fuck your wife was. I didn't even know she was married, you know, and John Hurt's yelling at him for fucking a fucking wife. But he just stays quiet, and then I wonder, how much does he even understand? He's French. Maybe he doesn't understand a word any of these people.
Yeah, that's what I thought the reveal was going to be.
Well, obviously he works in an English restaurant. I'm assuming he has a rudimentary skill. He probably understands, you know, wife effer, like that kind of stuff.
But for him to say, you owe me that, is a fantastic line, a fantastic window onto what he's thinking at that moment. You owe me that.
That's why he can't fight, because he's French, too.
He's surrender. Yeah, nice Kelly line. Okay, I have a question. So during the establishing shots, the exteriors, at some point you see in the background, they look like they're these big round edifices that look like the skeleton for what's going to be a big oil tank. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? I think you could see them in the Cronenberg movie Spider. I mean, they're a fixture of that part of London, I think. What are those? Do you guys even know what I mean?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
You're both fired. Okay, well, that was my question. Thanks for your help, jerks. Kelly. All right, so like I said, before the technical difficulties, you're both fired.
Round things? Like an oil derrick? What are you talking about?
The erotic world of Jacques Cousteau.
One, two, three, not only you and me, got 180 degrees and I'm caught in between. Counting one, two, three, feet apart and free.
The erotic world of Jacques Cousteau. I don't even want to know what that was or where that came from. What I do want to know...
He also said David Copper.
But what I do want to know, Dingus, is what is this week's 3x3?
This week's 3x3 are three instances of the breaking of the fourth wall. So in the past, we've had a discussion of voiceovers. And in last week's movie, The Loosers, we had a couple of examples that we didn't talk about during the podcast, and this isn't giving anything away about the movie. We had a couple of examples in the middle of the movie of sort of a half-assed breaking of the fourth wall, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out why the hell they did that. And so I started thinking about instances where that's done properly and to good effect, and so that's what this topic is about.
So why don't you explain to folks who may not have studied drama in college, what does it mean to break the fourth wall?
Why don't you explain it? How about that?
I didn't study drama in college. If it was a theology question, I could field it. This one, I got to kick it back to you.
They don't break the fourth wall in the Bible.
They do not. They're pretty good about that. God doesn't wink.
Well, the simplest way to put it is to say that the character in the film addresses the audience directly, not just in sort of
like God.
And it's sort of like a way of of acknowledging that they're characters, acknowledging that they're in a movie and that they're talking to the audience, and that, you know, when you're talking about theater, you're talking about there's sort of an understood wall between the audience and the stage, between the characters and the audience. And we accept that we are going to suspend our disbelief and decide that what's going on that stage is real, and there's a wall between us and those characters and those actors, and we're not going to run up on stage and grab their glass of water, and they're not going to walk out and sit in our lap. But in some instances in film and on stage, those characters will reach through the screen or reach past the stage and smack us in the face and say, what you're watching is fiction, and I'm a part of that fiction, and you are a part of it now, too.
And who, but don't you, can't you tell it already because there's only three walls, or in some cases, one wall?
Well, the fourth wall is an understood wall.
And who came up with this term, Dingus?
I believe Stephen Colbert, actually.
What about the ceiling? How come that doesn't count?
It's not a wall, it's a ceiling. Dingus, it was French philosopher Jacques Diderot.
So you sure that's how it's said?
Yeah, that's how I say it.
The erotic world of Jacques Diderot.
And actually, his first name isn't Jacques. I don't know what it is, but it's a Diderot.
So you looked that up just to say that, and now we're all just...
I actually knew that. I mean, I didn't know... I was going to quiz Dingus on that.
Oh, wait, it's French. You would have known it.
All right, so here we go. We have our instances then of breaking of Diderot's fourth wall. Who's first? Is it me? Because I go, I'm doing this.
Yes.
I've lost track of the whole. Kelly, you have to be 3x3 referee from now on. So it's me first. All right, let me call up.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the thing. Here's my twist. Surprise, surprise.
My favorite part.
I got rid of all the walls.
Breaking into the fourth wall is an established convention in a lot of storytelling. For instance, a monologue or a voiceover. I don't think of so much as breaking the fourth wall as building a wall that has built into it, into the plan, holes through which a character can address the audience. I wanted to try to avoid where this fourth wall wasn't broken so much as built to be porous. I hope I'm not stealing anybody's answer if I mention a movie like High Fidelity,
no,
where in High Fidelity, you know, that's part of the storytelling structure. So I don't think of that as breaking the fourth wall, as it's built a little differently. The three things I wanted to come up with were instances where somebody really broke it. Somebody really busted the rules. And the first one is the penis at the end of Fight Club. That gets inserted into film that we're watching. We learned that over the course of the movie, one of the subversive things that Tyler Durden would do is insert subliminal peni into animated movies to make people cry. And then at the very end of Fight Club, one of its final playful touches is a couple of frames of a big old penis. And I just love how that says, hey, Tyler Durden was messing around with the film that you are now watching. And I love that little instance of fourth wall breaking. Fight Club is full of that kind of thing, but just how that is a callback to one little moment earlier in the movie. So my number three choice is Fight Club.
I saw that as Tyler Durden is your projector, your projectionist for this movie.
Right. He was working at a theater, and he would do that exactly, which I imagine...
And you're supposed to cry.
I did not, I'm afraid. I was not a little girl.
No. You've still paused.
All right, so there's my number three. Kelly Wand, what is your number three favorite instance of breaking in the fourth wall?
Well, I didn't stick to your little rules.
You don't have to. That's fine. You don't have to do it.
Thank goodness. Maybe you could just do what the list is.
Yeah, I didn't go, oh, well, I came up with the much loftier idea of what the man who came up with the list had in mind, so yours will all suck. My number three was, I'm just going to say what it is, because I think no one cares about the draw out. They'll just, like, skip to the answer, including this part. In The Meaning of Life, the worst Monty Python movie, the best part, after the vomit, Eric Idle's this waiter who, like, takes you out and down this endless down these streets on this endless walk and into the countryside to show you the house where he was born. And then the camera just stays on him, and he feels like his story actually sucked, and then he just tells you to fuck off for not liking his story, and he walks off. And then the movie keeps going, unfortunately, but I really liked that. Okay, that's my number three. Good. Eric Idle telling the audience, fuck you.
I wished you had done that in a British accent.
No, not going to do that.
All right. Dingus, what is your number three favorite instance of breaking of the fourth wall, and can you do it in a British accent for us?
I certainly could, but it wouldn't make any sense for this film. And by the way, I'm just going to do Breaking the Fourth Wall. I really don't know what in the world you're talking about, Tom, with your porous analogies.
Well,
In fact,
it's part of the story, it's not the same as what he did.
Well, I just wanted to think of instances where the narrative was somehow broken rather than the rules being laid out that the actor was going to address the audience. And I'm not saying you guys have to do it, of course. It's just I challenged myself. I wanted to come up with things where I really felt that breaking of the fourth wall was kind of shocking or a surprise, because so often there's an agreement between the audience and the storytelling that this wall is going to be broken, so to speak, and I'm going to address you through this wall. I wanted to think of things where that wasn't a rule going into the movie. That wasn't part of how the movie, the contract established with the audience. Like in a monologue, for instance, you know, you see a Shakespeare play and you get a monologue, that breaks the fourth wall because basically, you know, you think, is it a soliloquy? Is the actor talking to himself? That's this agreement. You know, here is the audience sort of being addressed. That's actually not literally breaking the fourth wall.
Well, that's actually not the case. It's our understanding that it's an actor externalizing his thoughts. Now, stylistically, sometimes in plays, they might decide to do a monologue as if they were saying
right
to the audience, to a specific audience member or audience member.
Well, and some plays are written that way too, where
right,
a soliloquy or a monologue is directed to the audience. I mean, my example, and again, I really hope I'm not trumping anyone because this is a great example of it, but in High Fidelity, that's clearly part of the contract. The audience knows early on that the fourth wall is going to be porous. You know, that what's his name, is going to be talking to you through the fourth wall. So I just wanted to think of things that were a little different where that wasn't necessarily going to be the case, where I really felt that the wall was broken rather than not really even built in the first place.
You're going to steal my number one. What a jerk.
I don't think I am. You know what? Maybe I am Kelly Wand. Yeah.
Well, I went for me, it was much more important, and this is part of some of the objection I had when we were talking about, I think Kelly brought up Kiss Kiss Bang Bang when we were doing voiceovers.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's far more important that it be consistent, almost the opposite of what you're saying, that it's a consistent part of the storytelling, and that's far more gratifying
okay. Sure.
to me.
Sure.
So my number three then, I'll go ahead and give you guys a quote, as is my wont. I doubt you'll get it because you're Philistines.
Major Philistine.
I like looking back at people's faces in the dark.
Kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
No. I like noticing details that no one else sees, but I hate it in old movies when drivers don't watch the road.
American Beauty. Midnight Run.
Here's one more. Kaz.
I haven't seen this.
Rushmore.
No. And I couldn't do it in an English accent because all the words in this movie are spoken in a French accent, and this is the movie Amelie. 2001 movie directed by Jean-Pierre
Jeunet.
And as I said before this, I like it when a film incorporates breaking the fourth wall as part of the storytelling. And this movie is really heavy on narration from the outset. And then it breaks out of that when Amelie starts to look at us. Actually, she's not even the first person who does. It's this weird little moment where the neighbor next door who's in a coma sits up and speaks to us, and then Amelie finally looks to us as a child. And throughout the film, she looks at us, sort of drawing us in and making us a part of it, because her intention is in this movie is very clear. She wants to change people she wants to change her own life, but she wants to change people, and she wants us to be changed too. I think they want us as an audience to be changed too. And I think that part of that is reaching out to us and doing a good deed to us as an audience. And I'm crazy about this film anyway, but the breaking of the fourth wall in this film is beautiful. You couldn't have a better actress doing it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my number three, Amelie.
Dingus, you and I have a friend who claims during a Q&A session that Audrey Tautou was looking at him in much the same way that when you're watching Amelie, you feel that Audrey Tautou is looking at you. So,
Right. I was going to mention that he thinks she's his girlfriend, but then I know his girlfriend and I like her so much that I would never suggest such a thing.
Yes, it's our friend Charles who has an awesome girlfriend, but Charles maintains to this day that at a Q&A, I think it might have even been for Amelie, Audrey Tautou was looking at him.
Was that French movie
French movie she was in.
That war movie, The Long Engagement or something.
Ah, Very Long Engagement. Yeah.
I like that movie.
Yeah.
That's a good movie, isn't it?
Sure,
World War One?
Yeah. It's like a romance mystery World War One thing with Audrey Tautou running around looking adorable. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just dangerous to name a long movie a very long something.
Yeah. A bridge too long.
All right, my number two, and here Kelly Wan might be where I'm stealing yours, and I think Dingus might. Oh no, Dingus can't steal. Oh no, Dingus might steal mine. My number two, a movie we've all seen that Dingus didn't care for, and again, it fits for me because when you sit down to watch Funny Games, Michael Haneke's sort of a thriller thing, you think you're in for just another movie where some psychos terrorize a family. And there's murder and mayhem and terrible things happen. But Funny Games becomes all about breaking that fourth wall. You know, fairly early on, I'd say about a third, maybe halfway into the movie, one of the killers addresses the audience out of the blue. You've been watching a movie with a very, very distinct wall set up. You know, it's very third person, objective perspective on what's going on. And then at one point, one of these young psychopaths turns and says something to the audience, like, you want me to kill the dog or something like that.
He's doing that from the beginning. He's saying, oh, you're rooting for them. And you think,
right,
you're rooting against it. Yeah.
And it then becomes, you know, the fact that he can address the audience and that he can, he can manipulate what is going on. He can basically control reality. And there's a great little discussion they have at the very end on a boat where you wonder, you know, did this really happen? Is this a fiction they've dreamed up? But it's a classic instance of what Michael Haneke is so good at, which is this basically mind F storytelling. And Cash does it as well. Cash almost would have gone into this spot, but I just think it's so much, it's a little bit more raw and primitive and brutal in Funny Games, the way the fourth wall is broken. So that is my number two. Did I steal yours, Kelly Wand?
No, I thought about that one.
Okay. All right.
I went even more hardcore than you.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing it. So it's up to you. What is your...
Does
Dingus have anything to say about Funny Games?
Yeah, I think Dingus
might enjoy hearing.
Yeah, Dingus.
Dingus, what do you think about Funny Games?
What's interesting about this is because this is an obvious classic case of breaking the fourth wall, and I wondered if one of you guys was going to choose it. And I think the moment you're talking about, Tom, happens pretty early, and it's just a wink. When he is going after the dog, he just stops and turns full back to the camera and gives a wink. And for me, why Funny Games? And I don't think Funny Games is bad or worthless or anything like that. I think there's things that are worthy about Funny Games. But the breaking of the fourth wall in Funny Games for me ruins the film because I know it makes the film for you.
Well, I'd argue it's the point of the film too. I mean, it's cool.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Go ahead. So that's cool that you think it breaks it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it breaks it because it makes me realize that.
Or ruins it. You said it ruined it for you, not that it breaks it.
Well, either one is fine because I realize that. The filmmaker really doesn't care about these characters, and that I don't need to care about them either because none of this is real. And I know that's true about any film I watch, but I suspend my disbelief. And what he's giving me there in that moment is the permission not to.
Well, I think
I think that ruins it.
Okay, I think what you're mistaking is what you might have heard the filmmaker say, or what you believe the filmmaker says. But I don't see how anyone could watch Funny Games, because the first part of Funny Games is built to make you care about the characters. It introduces them. You sort of see them coming up to this house and unpacking. They're sympathetic characters. If you don't care about them, Dingus, I would say
Dingus is a sociopath.
Exactly. I would say you're like one of those kids. And
don't give any eggs to Dingus.
Well, I don't think there's any need to insult me.
But I'm just saying,
the early part of the movie,
you say that the director doesn't want you to care about the movie, the characters, but he's basically made, 20 minutes of a movie to establish the characters as sympathetic. Now, if that didn't work for you, that's fine. But No,
that totally worked for me. I loved those characters to that moment. And then when that guy turns around and winks at me, I realize where we're going to go. And I realize that there's a flash in that moment where I realize that anything can happen to them, and he's going to treat them like puppets. He's going to make me want... And you see this as the tension builds. He's going to make me want violence upon these two boys. He's going to make me wish for that, and then he's going to jerk that away from me. I felt all of that.
Well, Dingus, you don't know that until the scene with the remote control. I mean, there's a breaking of the fourth wall where an actor addresses the audience and says, you're in on this with me. But the rules of the reality, it's not established that they can manipulate that until the scene with the remote control. Now, at that point, yes, things look a lot more bleak for the mother and the father. I think the son might be dead at that point. But yes, at that point, things look a lot more bleak. But before then, there's nothing that gives you an indication one way or the other about who's going to live or die.
No, you're right. But I get the sense – I got the sense immediately that, when we go back in the house and they're beating the father, or whatever he does to the father to cripple him. That what Haneke is trying to do is make me want violence against these two boys. And knowing the film so far, I got the sense that he was going to punish me for wanting that. And so I started to think outside the film, because he was showing me a film outside the film. And it wasn't that I'm defective and I couldn't like those characters up to that point. I certainly did. But when he turns around and winks at me and breaks the fourth wall at that point, I realized, this isn't – I'm not really in for that type of a ride. He's trying to mess with me, and he's trying to tell me something about myself. So it's not that I'm defective and can't care for those characters.
Well, that's what you said, though. You said at that point you no longer cared about the characters.
No, it's that I realized he didn't care about his character.
So why should you?
Exactly.
Okay, well, I still cared about him. I still, even though I knew brutal things were going to happen to him and that maybe the director wasn't going to spare them, I still cared about the characters. So I don't necessarily see how that follows, that because you think the director's going to break the rules and be manipulative and try to manipulate you, which is the point of the movie, I don't know why at that point you feel that you don't care about the characters anymore. And I'm not trying to be insulting.
It's not that.
Okay.
It's that I don't believe they're characters anymore, and he doesn't either, as I found out later on.
Of course they are. Characters aren't real people. I mean, characters, whether they're in a novel or whether they're in some winking movie deprived of its fourth wall, are still characters. They are characters, Dingus. They are not real people. We know that. And we remove from it some of the luxury of misidentifying them as real people when we break that fourth wall. But they are still characters. They are still a mother and a father who have lost a son, and these two random dudes about whom we know nothing. So I disagree that when you say things like that they're not characters, or that
the filmmaker doesn't believe that.
How do you know what he believes? I mean, I can only know what's being presented to me in the movie. In the movie, even after this fourth wall is broken, to tremendous effect, I think, they are still characters. If you want to tell me Michael Haneke thinks they are no longer characters, I don't know what to say to that. I felt they were still characters.
Saying they're characters Haneke didn't care about. And then the movie turns into Crash and starts telling Dingus how he should feel about stuff, which gets his... makes us all feel the way we did after Crash.
Oh, I don't see the...
Comparing it to Crash, like predictable and like manipulative and like, don't tell me I'm racist.
I failed to see, though. I mean, I think I came to Funny Games knowing nothing about it, and I thought nothing about it was predictable. When it broke the fourth wall, you know, yes, the rules changed there. When the trick with the remote control happened, the rules changed there. When you see a long shot of the mother reacting to her son being murdered, that changes the rules. I don't think it's at all predictable. I do think it's manipulative in a very different way that Crash is manipulative. I mean, Crash is... Yeah, I felt predictable and manipulative, and that manipulation didn't really work for me. I can
understand. Those weren't characters.
Some people
in Crash.
They were characters, but I don't see it as manipulative.
But they felt like caricatures in Crash, and that's what Dingus is saying. Like, I see where he's coming from. To me, the movie worked.
Yeah, and same here. Yeah, but I just.
But he's saying. But I remember thinking during Crash, I don't believe in these people. And that's what he's saying he felt.
But I would argue that's because Crash is, in my opinion, poorly written. I don't think that Funny Games is poorly written.
Right. Yeah.
So.
But Dingus does.
Well, no, I don't. I think that Crash is bad because they're two-dimensional cliches and... That's a painful movie for other reasons. I don't think that these people are two-dimensional cliches. I just feel like suddenly I realize I'm watching scenes, and it's like I'm sitting on the set and watching scenes rather than sitting in my living room or in a movie theater and suspending my disbelief to watch actual people undergoing things. And when I watch a movie, that's what I'm doing. I'm suspending my disbelief so that I believe what's going on is actually going on, and those are actual people.
Well, so this is by that rationale, Dingus, any movie that breaks a fourth wall, you should feel the same way about. But you obviously feel very differently about the way that Funny Games breaks the fourth wall. That didn't impede your enjoyment of Amelie, for instance.
Certainly not, because I felt, this is an interesting discussion, because for Amelie, I feel like I'm being drawn in, whereas, and this might just be part of... part of my pride or part of the way I felt about the way Haneke was commenting on moviegoers. When I'm watching Funny Games, I feel like I'm being made fun of or being insulted, and I don't feel like that when I'm watching something like Amelie or my other two choices.
Sure. I would agree. It's an aggressive movie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It's meant to punish you. So yeah, that's your idea of fun, which to me and Tom it is. We like that.
And I see the qualities of the movie that appeal to you guys and make it a quality movie to some people, but it ruined the movie for me.
I liked it as a study in dread, in metaphysical dread. There's nothing you can do. You're screwed here, but you can try anyway.
Yeah,
but see that, you know, for me the dread was removed, and for me. I was dreading seeing the movie, and I dreaded it for a long time, and I willfully ignored
that might have hurt your
anything about it. Oh, certainly I'm willing to admit that, but I was expecting something else, and when this is what was panned out, the dread was removed for me. So it was an experience that left me wanting.
Mm-hmm. I went in nude at the far end of the movie.
Well, and I feel a little bit, I mean, I wasn't that into watching the remake, which because a lot of that surprise and it was in a way such a rote retelling of the original. I think the importance of Funny Games and whether or not it works for you can only happen once. And if you are now listening to all this and you haven't seen it, I'm afraid you're not going to get that because we've ruined it for you.
But Psycho, too.
Psycho,
it only works once.
Well, there's a very different kind of craft going on in Psycho.
Yeah, it's like a surprise ending, or it's a twist that we all knew about it before we even saw it, like when we were kids. Like, oh, it's Norman Bates. And then you finally get to see it, and you can't even enjoy it because everyone's ruined it. Just like Lucas ruined the Darth Vader reveal in Empire with the new prequels.
Let's not go there. All right.
You know, Hitchcock, Lucas...
All right, who's up? Who's number two is up? Is this you?
My number two. I'll be really quick.
Oh, okay. You don't have to be quick. No, that's a good discussion. I'm glad I didn't pick Cash. Then I picked that one instead.
Yeah, me too.
Yep. So, by the way, I just want to know somebody who would love the fact that we have these different reactions, and he would probably enjoy your reaction more, Dingus. I'm guessing Michael Haneke himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So.
Well, Haneke makes it sound like we're the douches for seeing the whole movie. That's how he put it. Like, if you if you see the whole movie, you need it. So he's praising Dingus. He's saying, see, Dingus hated the movie. Dingus is cool.
I didn't hate the movie, but I watched the whole movie, so I'm just as culpable as you if I had turned it
but
off.
But Hanukkah would give you an A and me and Tom Fs.
Right.
And it would give me a C. Which me and Tom are totally satisfied with. Like, yep.
That's right.
Proud F.
Glad I failed.
Mission accomplished.
All right, thanks, Kelly Wan, what is your number two? Go for it.
My number two is a movie with this quote. Wait. Yeah.
Okay, wait, let me guess. Wait, yeah.
You ought to go to bed or you'll fall asleep at the table. Tom?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
A little film called Persona.
What? What's that?
By Ingmar Bergman. Your favorite
director. that's a JRPG. It's a Shin Megami Tensei JRPG. Duh.
Casablanca.
I've never seen Persona. Yeah, I don't.
Oh, you can go to film school.
That's what I saw. And it's Ingmar Bergman, right.
Yeah, it's one of his most famous movies, Tom.
Should I not listen to this part of the podcast?
Is there a character named Tom?
There's erect penises.
Whoa.
And a subliminal film coming unwound as her psyche.
First of all, that's so not true. That is not its Persona. That's in Persona? Isn't that movie from like 1939 or something?
It's the 50s. Which part are you doubting?
The erect
penis?
Yeah.
No, it's in there.
Are you lying?
I think not.
All right.
I can't remember. It's about these two women. It's like that movie, The Tenant. Remember that Roman Polanski movie?
Never seen it.
It's a foreign film. They can have erect
Philistines. Yeah, they're Swedish. It's about two women who have issues with each other, and one of them's going nuts. It's like, what's that movie with Betty Davis where she cooks the rats?
Fatal Attraction.
Harold and Maude.
You know what? Oh, it's ironic you said that when you hear my number one. Spoiler alert. Anyway, my number two is Persona when the film breaks. I don't want to spoil it because Tom hasn't seen it.
Did that actually happen?
Yeah, the film breaks after her feet start to bleed because the girl staying with this actress, Lee, drops a bottle and these glass shards cut the chick's feet on the footpath, and then the film breaks when her feet starts to bleed.
This was in the 50s?
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
It's a great movie.
All right.
Oh, wait, it's 66. I'm sorry. That's what I meant by the 50s. It's in black and white, so it's the 50s.
I considered a movie with the film breaking. That's a good choice.
Oh, yeah. Was it? Well, never mind. We'll talk about it later. Okay, good. So, Dingus, what is your number two?
My number two, I'm going to give you a quote because it's probably my favorite quote of all time, ever. It's one of my favorite movie quotes ever.
Is it going to die?
That's it. Jar Jar Binks is clearly looking at the camera when he says that. And everybody else can't see Jar Jar Binks, and they're looking at us.
Their eyes are focused in various places, often beyond the camera. Yes.
Yes, and that is clearly, there's no fourth wall because, you know, George Lucas doesn't know that term. So
he'll make a good senator. Spoiler alert.
No, it is not Jar Jar Binks, but thanks for linking Jar Jar Binks to the movie I'm about to talk about. One of my favorite movies of all time, and I appreciate that, Kelly Wand.
By the way, before you go on, Dingus, I cannot wait for the day that we have a podcast where Star Wars never comes up. I look forward to that. One day. That's my dream. I have a dream.
I think we're contractually obligated as 2:45.
Probably.
What's awesome is that you guys are always the ones.
That's kind of true, isn't it?
We're baiting you. We're baiting the bull, and it never works.
Yeah, and we're getting the horns.
That's right.
All right, Dingus, what is your quote from your number two favorite instance of fourth wall breaking?
In a Star Wars movie. The crawl at the beginning over the stars, that's kind of the breaking fourth wall. It's a dark time for the Alliance.
If the words had been coming at us and shattering into the audience, then yeah. But they're going away from us. So they're building the fourth wall.
Good point.
All right, here we go. The important thing, I think, is not to be bitter. If it turns out there is a God, I don't think he's evil. I think the worst you can say about him is that basically he's an underachiever.
God, Dingus. All right, can we move to my number one now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Wait.
I was worried somebody was going to bring up Woody Allen.
Yeah, but I only chose one. I limited myself.
All right. I've just recently seen. I'm still trying to get past the trauma of having sat through that frickin' Whatever Works movie with Larry David, which is enough to sour me on every Woody Allen thing ever. So,
like Sour Grapes, the Larry David directed one.
All right, so which one? Actually, I don't know what movie it's from, Dingus.
Do you not know either, Kelly Wand?
I thought it was Whatever Works.
Yeah.
What's the one with?
Well,
the
it's got to be Love and Death. I'm guessing it's Love and Death, which is Bergman kind of riff, right?
Right, it is Love and Death, and it's one of my favorite movies, and that's one of my favorite quotes. And he breaks the fourth wall a couple of times during the movie where he just – he does this in a lot of his films.
Yeah.
And the most famous one is a different Woody Allen film. I chose not to use that one. I chose to use this one because his monologue at the end when he says, I'm dead, and they're talking about wheat. And he gives my favorite quote about God in anything, that, you know, God, if he does exist, I don't think you can say he's evil. I think that basically he's an underachiever, is one of my favorite things ever. And I love the way Woody Allen does this, the way he, again, the way he draws us into the film. He talks to us about the weighty matters. I mean, that's what this movie is about, but it's also... because this movie is sort of goofing on Russian literature a bit, he's doing that thing that novelists can do without really calling attention to themselves, which is talking directly to us. And he does this in a couple of instances in this film, during the film, and it's, yeah, my number two.
And the
Tom,
thing is,
why do you hate Love and Death?
I don't. You know what? I should go back and watch it just to remember when Woody Allen was great. It really was. Have you guys seen Whatever Works?
No.
No. I can't watch anything he does.
I don't like any of his new stuff.
Yeah, the thing is, it's really traumatic. And part, Dingus, you describing that, Whatever Works is so in love with its breaking of the fourth wall. Larry David, early on, gets up. You know, he's doing a scene, and he goes to the camera, and he says, okay, I know you're sitting in a movie theater, you're eating popcorn, and he does it, and the gimmick in Whatever Works is that the people around him hear him, and they're like, who are you talking to? And he says, I'm talking to the people out there watching the movie, and they're all like, what? What are you talking about? Are you crazy? And he's like, no, they're out there watching
this
theater.
That sounds funny.
It's not, though. Imagine Larry
what?
David.
You're making it sound good.
Okay. You know what, Kelly? What? Yeah, rent Whatever Works. Yeah, you guys should see that movie. It's great. Yeah.
Watch well, that. Are there consequences for this as the movie goes on? Or
no, does... no. And furthermore, it's how the movie closes. Like, everything has sort of a happy ending, and everybody's all together in a room happy, and Larry David is addressing the audience and the entire cast. It's, you know what? It's like the end of a Saturday Night Live episode. The entire cast is up there on stage, and Larry David's talking to the audience. But the difference is the cast is like, who are you talking to? What's going on out there? And it's, oh, God, it's wretched. And the funny thing is, it should be good Woody Allen material, you know. He's always been very existential and very aware of death and the human condition, and here he is older, and he's trying to struggle with this from the perspective of someone his age, and it's just pathetic to watch. God, I hated it. And there's good actors in it. Patricia Clarkson is in it and just embarrasses herself, and I... Oh, God. Okay, let's move on.
The last one I liked, the last Woody Allen that was good for me was Match Point.
Same thing.
Maybe I like that one too much, but I thought it was great.
He's a good filmmaker, even doing genre films. Yeah, I know. Well, he can be. You know what? I think, yeah, he can be. I saw Cassandra's Dream, which had a very good Colin Farrell performance in it, but was full of just really amateurish crap where it just seems like he's doing movies just really quickly now and spitting them out. I mean, there were things where the take was bad or the lighting wasn't good. So I just think maybe he's moving too fast. And so here, obviously, the material and Whatever Works, he's really close to that, but it's just crap. And instead, you're right, Kelly Wand, the best thing he's done recently is a straight-up genre movie. Yeah.
He has no reason to prove himself. Like, he's just this grand old man.
Yeah.
He's like Lucas. And I think that when you reach a certain age, unless you're a Scorsese, unless there are exceptions, you usually are never as good as you once were. It's like athletes.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what the thing is, like a novelist, like how old is Cormac McCarthy, for Pete's sake? That guy is still...
He's an exception to every rule, though.
Is he really? But come on, you know, Falk...
But also the road in... never mind.
But I really do think that... When you're dealing with the kinds of subjects that Woody Allen wants to talk about, as you get older, I mean, what you say and how you say it should, I think, become richer. And I see that in people like
McCarthy
and in Walker Percy and William Faulkner and, you know, novelists. And I don't know Ingmar Bergman's movies, but come on, that's got to be the case with him, right? You know, the Coen brothers, for Pete's sake, A Serious Man, the arc from Blood Simple to A Serious Man.
That's true.
I just, you know, why can't Woody Allen?
But they're not old yet. And most of Cormac's stuff is better, like the older stuff's better. Like Blood Meridian was like 30 years ago.
I disagree. I mean, I don't think anything holds up like The Road.
Well, Woody Allen was dealing with in Love and Death, he was dealing with talking about death, pretending to be a character who was this, you know, his standard character, when in reality he's a virile athletic guy as a young man, and he's dealing with issues of death and a character who can't get laid, and but that wasn't really who he was. He's an athletic young guy who had plenty of chicks. And now he's an old man who has to deal with death in a more realistic way, and it's more close at hand, and he's not the guy he was really. He wasn't the real guy anymore. He's the guy who was making fun of, in a way. So, I mean, it's difficult to make that transition, and he hasn't. I mean, he was making films of his idol, Ingmar Bergman, you know, sort of cribbing those and
but it's like you making, say, yeah, MJ, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. And making an homage to them. And now he's gotten to the point where he should be making films about where he is in life.
Right.
I mean, Crimes and Misdemeanors is a film that I would expect him to be making now, but he's apparently instead making things with Larry David.
You know, in a way, I really do. I mean, I don't want to subject you guys to this, but I really would encourage maybe just putting whatever works in your Netflix queue and just looking at a few of the monologues, because it really is. I mean, seriously, it really does seem like it's like you were saying, Dingus, Love and Death is all about it's Russian literature, and he's influenced by Bergman and Fellini. You know, Stardust Memories is 8.5. So he's a younger director struggling with the same issues, but he's obviously influenced by these much greater, older artists from classical literature and film. And now that he's this age, instead of, like we're saying, turning in that level of stuff himself, it just seems just so sort of effete and flailing, and it just seems so clumsy, which is really disappointing to me. This guy who was so influenced by these other great artists makes whatever works. Just, God.
Well, that's his basketball. That's his country album.
But the weird thing is that is a script, and now that I think about it, that he had lying around in his drawer for a long time, and because of the writer's strike or something, he had to just drag it out of his drawer and decide to make it. And I think he had originally wanted to make it with Zero Mostel, and I think Zero Mostel died before they could make it, and then he just shelved it, and then when he needed something on the quick, he pulled this out and said, who can I make this with? So
it's his intolerable cruelty.
All right. Wow. How did we get off? So your number two, Dingus, was a good Woody Allen movie.
Yes. Well, at least from my perspective, some people would find it overbearing and silly, but I love it. And it, just to bring the topic back around, this is the first instance I can really remember as a young man of seeing the fourth wall broken and it resonating with me. And, you know, I saw this probably 25 years ago, and it made an impact on me back then. And it was the first time that I'd seen that happen that I recall where it sort of made an impression on me.
Right. Good. All right. So I think we are down to our number ones. Kelly, I wasn't jotting. I should write these down. Real quick. I'm sorry. Fight Club for me. Kelly, what was your number three?
Meaning of Life.
Meaning, Dingus, your number three, Star Wars.
Right.
What was your number two, Tom? The listeners will want to know.
My number two was Funny Games. Dingus, yours was Love and Death. What was your number three, Dingus?
Number three was Amelie.
Oh, right, right, of course. Okay.
This is just embarrassing.
All right, so, no, I just...
I feel bad for people listening to this.
My cat...
Kelly Wand, you just broke the fourth wall of this podcast.
Nice work.
That's true, huh?
So, my number one, and I'm glad Dingus didn't steal this from me, because I know we've talked about it before, I love, love, love this brutal, just heartfelt Romanian movie called 4 weeks, or 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. And it's about... this isn't a spoiler, but I loved that. I didn't know this going into the movie. It's about communist era Romania and these a woman who gets an abortion. And it's a movie, you know, we talked about Dread before with Funny Games, and there's some of this in 4-3-2, as I'll call it as shorthand. There's this sense of dread as you're going through the movie and as you see what a woman in communist Romania had to go through to get an abortion. And the two actresses, one who has to get the abortion, the other who is her friend who's helping her, are just so good. And there are these great scenes, and the movie constantly sets you up to expect the worst. And it's a real emotional roller coaster. And it ends with, and there's so much sort of social commentary in there about the effects of communism, about abortion, and it ends after these girls have been through so much with a scene of them just sitting at a table, and they've sort of come through to the far end of this ordeal, and they are just sitting there, and the lead actress just glances up at the camera, and then it cuts. And it's this powerful moment of connection with the audience, and it to me is an example of when breaking the fourth wall, it's a best case example of it, because here you followed these two women through this ordeal and you feel for them, and then finally one of them makes this fleeting connection with you, and then it's lost in a cut to black, and then there's a pause and the credits come up. But that final shot in 4 weeks, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days just seals the deal, and it's just so brutally effective. The moment you get that contact, you lose it, and the movie's over. And the movie, in a way, isn't concerned with what is going to happen to these women after they've been through this. And in fact, what you've just heard from them, the conversation at the table, is the one girl saying to the other girl who just had the abortion, "We're not going to talk about this ever again."
Right.
And then she looks at the audience, and it ends. And it just it's such a powerful statement, too, about... You know, so few movies are—I say so few movies. It's all too rare that the unique experience of being a woman is presented in a movie, and this movie is about, ultimately. I mean, what this all comes about is—it's ultimately about what it must be like. I mean, how it must be for women to have to go through terrible things like rape or abortion, and to not be able to share that or talk about that. How that gets locked up inside, and this is all wrapped up in this just tremendous movie set in, you know, communist Romania, and it's got some social commentary, but it's ultimately about two women and, I guess, a plight that is unique to women. And it ends with that very effective breaking of the fourth wall. So that's my number one pick.
Just as how 44-inch chest shows how it is to be a man, and no one hurts like a man.
Well, it's like, you know, and that's one of the things is 44-inch chest, and I don't want to get too much off on that in case you haven't seen it yet, those of you listening, but 44-inch chest is very much about something sort of unique to the male experience that goes all the way back to, as I mentioned, the Bible and Homer and Shakespeare.
And cavemen.
There's not a lot of that about women's experiences in 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. Like I said, as far as like women undergoing rape and abortion, those are things that men don't really understand. It's not part of the male experience, and generally it's not part of classic literature. It's not part of the storytelling that we historically get. So
that moment is, if I say breathtaking, that doesn't really get it, because breathtaking is used so frequently, like the word awesome. But that moment when I saw it made me catch my breath. It made me, I mean, that moment, you don't, at first you're thinking, did that happen?
Yeah.
That is such a beautiful instance of this. And I was so close on that moment. It didn't fit with what I was looking for as far as consistency, but it's such a beautiful example of how a film uses breaking the fourth wall to get its point home and touch us. And I wanted to watch it again this week, and unfortunately I couldn't work it in. It is available on Instant Watch on Netflix. So I was gonna just watch and just run to the end and see that again, but I couldn't do it. But that is just such a great choice, Tom. I mean, it's just such a great choice, especially now. You know, I sort of made fun of what your special list was, but this perfectly gets what your special challenge for yourself was. It's a breathtaking moment. You got to see this movie. It's just phenomenal. That's great, Tom. Good job.
Thank you. Okay, Juan, you haven't seen it.
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I just want to say, I don't think straight people say breathtaking as often as they say awesome.
So I actually described Brokeback Mountain as something like breathtakingly lovely once and was mocked for it.
Yeah.
Which is kind
of you can't call the Ian McShane performance breathtaking either. You'll get the same giggles.
All right, Kelly Wan, what is your number one instance of the breaking of the fourth wall? Kelly, what was your again, real quick?
Persona.
Right. All right. Okay. Now, what was your number one?
By your favorite director. My number one. I know you think I was going to do something stupid like Burt Reynolds.
Well, because you were worried I was going to steal yours. You obviously weren't worried I was going to steal Meaning of Life or Persona. So it's something
That's Bergman 2 weeks in a row, isn't it?
It is. We're on a Bergman roll.
Awesome.
Not by the same dude, though.
That's breathtaking.
Next week, next week we'll be watching Wild Strawberries. All right, Kelly, what is your number one?
Well, okay, so I didn't do a goofy Burt Reynolds one because that would have been silly, and I want to take these 3x3s really seriously because I think the listeners. Yes, I telegraphed it. So, with the Burt Reynolds moratorium imposed, I went with a TV movie from the 80s you may be familiar with called Bates Motel. It was a TV movie follow-up to Psycho with Bud Cort in it.
Ah, the Harold and Maude reference, yes.
Yeah. And there's like a girl in a chicken suit. I forget what her role is, but basically you find out that a bunch of teenagers killed themselves. I don't really know what it has to do with the Bates Motel thing, but the ghosts of all the dead teenagers like teach Bud Cort responsibility. And then at the end, he looks at the camera and he goes, "Nobody ever said life was easy, but nothing really worth it ever is. But you know, I think with a little luck, we're going to do okay here. I think Norman would have liked it. By the way, if you ever need a room, come on by. Can't say for sure what you'll find, but that's what makes the world go round."
Oh my God.
And then it ends. And then that's the end of the sequel to Psycho. So,
wow.
That's my number.
That's breathtaking. God. All right.
So, wait, let me get this straight. You chose a TV movie. And
yeah.
When
you picked a Civil War movie, right?
When I chose Gettysburg, which had a theatrical release, you got all up in my grill.
Kelly,
well, no, I accepted you were right. You convinced me that TV movies can be.
It had a theatrical release, bitch.
Oh. Well, that wasn't the lesson I learned. Just as Bud Cort taught me that killing myself when I was a teenager wasn't what Norman Bates would have wanted. Because that's what Psycho, the whole franchise, is about. It's like teenage suicide.
Wow.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
So should we rent Bates Motel for this, Kelly Wand?
Just YouTube that very end part.
Okay. All right, good. So number one, Bates Motel. Kelly Wand's favorite instance of breaking of the fourth wall. Good. Dingus, can you top that? That's a tough one to top. I don't know. What do you got?
Zapped, I guess. mine's going to be entirely anticlimactic because you willfully ruined it.
Oh, God dang it. Well, I, you know what? I was even thinking maybe somebody will pick that. I should think of a better example, but I couldn't think of a better example. Oh, God. At least I couldn't think of the actor's name.
Or at least you couldn't say the word properly.
What
could
word?
You say the title again?
High Fidelity.
It's Fidelity.
That's what I said.
It's not Fidelity. There's no Fi. It's not it's Hi-Fi.
It's like Wi-Fi, Hi-Fi. Yeah.
Sci-Fi.
Yeah, Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fiction? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
High Fidelity.
They took a neologism that didn't make sense, and then they respelled it, Sci-Fi.
I'm sorry, Dingus. I really
was. Tom's overlords.
No, I'm really sorry, though. I did not. I should have been more careful about that. So, because that is a great one. I mean, it's so well built into the narrative. I'm just stepping on your toes even more. So
Tom also said, "Oh, anything with voiceovers where you just talk to the camera, that's weak."
All right. So tell us why you picked High Fidelity.
There's no worries about breaking this one up. This is an obvious one, and I didn't limit the category, so I'm stuck. From the first moment, it's soup to nuts, a breaking of the fourth wall movie. And in some ways, I kind of, now that you've done your number one, I'm a little bit envious because this is not really breaking the fourth wall so much as a completely broken fourth wall the entire way through. From the moment he says, what came first, the music or the misery? But it this movie just does it so perfectly, and part of it is well, everybody, the writing, it's the actor, it's the direction, it just comes together perfectly. It's one of my favorite films anyway. It was directed by Stephen Frears. It's from 2000, and he just has so many moments. I have a hard time expressing why. Why I think this is so great, but here's an example. And sometimes in narration, or you get the sense that they're telling us something that already happened. And when he's talking in this movie, he's talking in the past tense. There's a moment where where Charlie, who is played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, says something about not wanting to have kids, and he says to us. I'm not making this up. This is how she talks, as if nobody had ever had a conversation about having kids in the entire history of the world. She's incredible. And there's another moment after he's first met Lisa Bonet, but he's had a conversation with his sister or his friend, who's played by his sister, about his ex-girlfriend, and Lisa Bonet is making a pass at him. He says, "Okay, just hold on just a second." And he goes into this room and he just yells, "What fucking Ian guy?" to us. And we're constantly the person he's talking to. But the feel is that it's not that he's a narrator expressing what has happened and telling us a story. But for me, it's a feeling of this has happening, and he's discovering it and discovering who he is as he's going along, and he's letting us in on the situation. And what I said before when I was talking about Love and Death, how Woody Allen kind of cheats and does something that a novel can do in speaking to us, for me, this film, it's like sort of that perfect way of expressing a novel to us, speaking a novel to us. It's just this wonderful way of adapting a novel so that it's happening in real time almost, and the character is learning about himself and bringing us along for that as if we were reading it, but it's graphic. And I love the way that the fourth wall is shattered throughout this film. And there's even a Marshall McLuhan moment with Bruce Springsteen that happens in it, which made me more comfortable with leaving Annie Hall behind. And I like how that even happened in this film. And it's consistent throughout the film, which was part of the challenge, not the challenge, but part of the criteria I was going for when I was talking about fourth wall breaking. It has some sense of consistency throughout the film. And so High Fidelity, or High Fidelity, as some might say, is reasonable.
I like your choice, Dingus. I don't care what Tom says.
I like it too. It just didn't fit my own personal challenge. I quite like it. And And I think you're right.
You are the one who always goes, yeah, you know what? I didn't do this movie. And then that's always one of someone's movies.
I've never done that. What are you talking about?
Nah.
Good rebuttal.
Game, set, match.
It really is like it's such a great way to adapt that whole the luxury a novel has of you're in a narrator's head.
Right.
If you can't get in his head in a movie, you know what? Then he'll bring you into the movie. Like it's such a great alternative to yeah. Good. All right. High fidelity. Fidelity, fiddle, whatever, right.
Fidelity.
Let's talk about bad instances of breaking the fourth wall. I just want to mention, have you guys seen Into the Wild, that Sean Penn adaptation of the novel about the kid who died in Alaska?
Yeah, I don't remember the fourth wall.
This is an instance of bad breaking of the fourth wall. It looks like Emil Hirsch is just like goofing around. It's a shot where I presume they're setting up the camera or something, and I seem to recall he was like tossing an apple around in his hands. And he's just mugging at the camera, and it seems like a bored actor waiting for the shot to get set up. And for some reason, and he's totally like, you know, making faces at the camera. And for some reason, Sean Penn decides to put this shot into the Wild, which I hated. I'm like, you know what, Killian, it's a story. Don't just toss in your extra footage because you think Emil Hirsch is being funny or something. I hate.
Well, is that what he's doing? Why he's doing that?
I don't know why he's doing it.
Just hate Emil Hirsch, and he's doing S. See what an asshole this guy is. Just like Emil Hirsch. Bored. Apple juggling. He had it coming.
How do you guys feel about found footage movies? Like
Mission
Paranormal Activity, for instance. We had talked about...
I'm totally gay for even the lame ones. I even like The Objective.
Well, as far as the fourth wall, though. Like, here's why I ask. Because to me, a found footage movie never even has a fourth wall. By its very concept, that wall is never even there to be broken. You know, the camera is one of the actors. You know, the audience perspective is in the movie. So that when, you know, I think it's her name, Katie Featherstone, when Katie at the end of Paranormal Activity looks into the camera, she's not breaking any fourth wall. It was never there to begin with.
And Blair Witch, huh?
Same there, yep. That as well.
Those aren't examples of bad.
Well, I'm just saying that it's kind of the part of the conceit of a found footage movie is that fourth wall isn't there in the first place.
Right, I agree. I think of that more as if we're watching a documentary or something.
Right, exactly.
Where you can't really consider that. For me, a bad example of breaking the fourth wall is when it happens at one point in the film, and then it just there's no real explanation for it, and it never really happens elsewhere.
Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang. Or, well, it's not so bad in Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang, but they lose sight of this great gimmick in Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang, don't they?
Well, for me, it's like, do you remember a film you liked a lot more than I did, and this was one of the movie club picks. It was Gangster Number One.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in the film, Malcolm McDowell's in the bathroom, and some of his urine splashes into, like, goes into his champagne glass or whatever. And he's going to drink from it,
right.
And he looks at the camera and he says, "What do you take me for?"
Right.
And I just don't...
Wah, wah, wah.
And what do you take me for, a C word?
Right.
And I was like, whoa, okay. And then I don't see where else that goes. And so I don't...
He just peed in front of you. That's what I get out of it.
Yeah.
Did you guys see The Fourth Kind? Ugh.
Oh, God.
I rented that the other night, and I'm still annoyed about it.
Wait, real quick, before we talk about Fourth Kind. So, Dingus, I agree with you there, but and this might be one of these sort of creative gymnastics things that I had to do because I liked the movie. Like, I've, you know, you and I, Dingus, are notorious for trying to come up with these for 28 minutes later. It's imaginary zombie dad, you know. But so my thing with, I think, Gangster Number One is much of the movie is Malcolm McDowell's reminiscence. He talks to us, and then this vision we see of him as this young, sleek, ruthless gangster played by Paul Bettany is his own image. You know, at that point, we're brought into his recollection of it rather than necessarily a third-person objective perspective on it. And he's kind of like old and broken down and a little full of himself. And he's come a long way since that sleek, sexy young gangster played by Paul Bettany. So, yeah, but I agree that that's an instance where it's like, hey, what happened to that you know, talking to the audience thing. Yeah.
You know, it's not as bad. It's not as bad as, say, like, and I don't think either of you have probably seen this, but like something like Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where it's the kind of movie where characters are constantly saying, who would ever want to watch this movie? It's not as bad as that. I don't mean that, but I can accept your justification for it.
By the way, I wish they had said that in The Fourth Kind.
I was
angry at that stupid movie.
Yeah, I was too. I was furious.
So Dingus, the conceit for Fourth Kind is that there are these tapes of a psychoanalyst with her patients in Nome, Alaska, and strange, crazy things, like basically UFO abductions have been happening up there, and there are these actual tapes, so they hire Mila Jovovich and other actors to reenact these tapes, and in these they sometimes show the original tapes, and they interview
split screen
exactly side by side, and they interview the actual psychoanalyst who Mia Jovovich is playing in the movie. They have interviews with her also in the movie, and then when the credits come up, no actress is listed for this supposed psychoanalyst. So the movie, with the credits and everything, wants you to think that this footage that's supposed to be from, I don't know, the 80s or so, I forget how old it's supposed to be, is real. And the director himself of this movie appears in the movie as himself interviewing the supposed actual psychoanalyst whose patients were UFO abducted. And it's so just crass. I mean, the actress, it's so funny if you, because I saw this and I went online. I was like, I'm not falling for this. This is stupid. You know, because the actress playing the supposed actual psychoanalyst played by Mila Jovovich is actually very good. And she looks really weird and kind of scary looking. So people online have found her website. And, you know, she's not listed on IMDb. So is it Sony Pictures, Kelly Wand, or Paramount? Do you remember?
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, but those.
I bailed after you find out they speak Sumerian. Did anything good happen after that?
I'm sure there was just more of the same crap.
Who's that director think he is? Werner Herzog?
Very
or
good.
Night Shyamalan Dingus. From Lady in the Water. Right.
No, Dingus was making not Mystery at Loch Ness. What's it called? Incident at Loch Ness. An Incident at Loch Ness reference, which is exactly what. An example of what Fourth Kind was trying to do, except Incident at Loch Ness works and is amazingly funny. Scary. I mean,
is that Herzog?
Chilling. It's Werner. He didn't direct it, but it's about Werner Herzog making a documentary.
So it's his Freddy's New Nightmare.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'll go with that. So. All right, let's move on. So here's what we're doing next week for 3x3. You guys ready for this? What the heck was that? Was that Green Acres? Did you just hum the theme to Green Acres?
Whenever you say y'all ready for this, I
I see. Right. Okay. Good. So what I want from you guys next week, thing is, I give you a lot of guff for this because a lot of people quote lines from Star Wars, and it's the equivalent of an inside joke, except that Star Wars is so widespread that it's not an inside joke anymore. And I maintain that a lot of the dialogue in Star Wars is not actually inherently good or interesting, but it's just famous because the movie is so freaking famous. For instance, that's no moon. That is a stupid line. That means nothing. That's a stupid line for people to quote. All it is, it's just a reference to what happened to be said at a key moment in the movie. That's not good dialogue. You know, I got a bad feeling about this. Holy crap, that's not a quotable line. Quit saying it to each other.
It's a breathtaking line.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
No one says that. Who says there's no moon? Oh, never mind.
Please, come on. Star Wars.
I never hear
Pete. Jeez, Pete. So what I want from you guys, Now, but certain lines, though, when you take famous lines from movies, I mean, certain lines, they're so well written, or they either fit the character or the tone of the movie so well that they become famous. You know, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. We're going to need a bigger boat. It was Beauty Killed the Beast. We'll always have Paris. I can't quit you. You know, those are good lines. They come from good writing. They mean something. They evoke context. They're famous lines for a reason. So what I want from you guys next week are three movie lines that should be famous.
That aren't necessarily.
Right. So are there any questions?
Good. But there, wait, so none of them can be famous. They all have to be obscure, and they're not already famous.
You don't have to be obscure, but, you know, use your own judgment as far as what's famous, what's not famous. I just want...
What if I believe that this Snow Moon should be famous?
Well, I'm pretty sure that is famous, but I just want from you, you can game it however you like, Kelly Wand. The only criteria it has to meet for you personally is that you feel it should be famous. So ideally, it's not famous, but you feel it should be famous, that it's a movie line worth being famous.
You just did a whole list of – you just spat out a whole bunch of movie lines before you did that. I'm just wondering if one of them is from one that is breathtakingly lovely.
Can I take the fifth on that? I mean,
that's a good one.
You don't think I can't quit you? I mean, everybody thinks Brokeback Mountain when they – from that, right?
Can I take the fifth from 12 Angry Men?
All right, so that's what I want from you guys next week. I look forward to what you come up with. And here's, by the way, why I thought of it. It was rewatching 44-inch Chest. I don't know specifically that I would pull one out of that movie, but there were just so many good lines in there that any time some doofus quotes Star Wars at me, I would rather he quoted something 44-inch Chest. So
well, you're going to get a lot of the C word at Shoot Club from now on.
All right, gentlemen. So also, let's see Iron Man 2 next week. Are you guys psyched?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Summer's here. Budget summer movie.
Because I think he says, I'm the Iron Man, bitch.
And that can be one of your choices for the 3x3, Dingus. All right, so join us next week for Iron Man, for our 3x3 of movie lines that should be famous. I am Tom Chick. And I have been joined by Christian Mististi. Did I get it close?
Mm-hmm. It's close. It's Christian Moroski.
Oh, I was.
You can say Mististi. That's fine.
And I also have with me, of course, Kelly Wand.
May the force be with you. Such a jerk. Oh, the fourth wall kind.